Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Take AIM, Accuracy in Media's weekly talk show on Blog Talk Radio. AIM is America's original media watchdog, and every week we point out biased coverage and bring you the stories the mainstream media ignore. We encourage you to visit our website at aim.org and sign up to receive our daily email so you can keep track of what the media are up to. I'm Roger Aronoff, a media analyst with AIM, and we have a special show today, two great guests, and I will be handling the interview in the first half with Cliff May, the president of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and Don Irvine, my co-host and the chairman of AIM, will be handling the second half hour, which will be an interview with Leslie Carbone, who has a new book out called Slaying the Leviathan. So we will be getting into this shortly as soon as we hear from Cliff May. Cliff is just back from Pakistan and will have a lot of interesting things to say. And Cliff has an interesting background, formerly a reporter for the New York Times, foreign correspondent, and very diverse background, very knowledgeable person. And so we look forward to getting, it looks like he's here now, and I'm going to go ahead and put him on the line here. Hi, Cliff, you there?
Hey, I am indeed.
Good morning. Great to have you with us on
Take AIM.
Good
to be with you.
Thank you.
Good to be with you.
So let me first tell our audience a little about you. Cliff May is the president of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, which is a policy institute focusing on terrorism. It was created immediately following the 9/11 attacks on the U.S. He is also chairman of the policy committee of the Committee on the Present Danger. In 2008, the Daily Telegraph of the UK named Cliff one of the 100 most influential conservatives in America. A veteran news reporter, foreign correspondent, and editor at the New York Times and other publications, he has covered stories in more than two dozen countries. He writes a weekly column that is nationally distributed by Scripps Howard News Service, and he is a regular contributor for National Review Online, The American Spectator, and other publications. And he's recently back from a trip to Pakistan. That's why we wanted to have him on here at this time, and we'll be very interested in his perspective about what is going on over there. But let's do a little background first. Cliff, tell us about you. It's not often that someone in one lifetime as both a foreign correspondent for the New York Times and among the 100 most influential conservatives in America.
Yeah. Well, I'm afraid there's only about 101 influential conservatives left in America is the problem. I spent a lot of my career, more than 20 years in journalism, a lot of that for the New York Times and Africa and Washington and New York and many other places. I left the Times and went out to Colorado to be associate editor of a newspaper there, the Rocky Mountain News, for a few years. And then when Jim Nicholson got elected chairman of the Republican Party, he asked me to come back to Washington with him as a communications director. I had been a columnist and an editorial writer, so he kind of knew that I had drifted to the right and from where I had started. I don't know that there's ever been another New York Times correspondent who ended up as a communications director for the Republican Party. And then briefly, after 9/11, I was very seized by the issue of terrorism and the ideologies that drive terrorism and the threat of terrorism to America and to its allies. And with inspiration and input from Jack Kemp and Gene Kirkpatrick and others, I formed something called the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, which is a think tank, but a very activist think tank on these issues. We do research. I try to identify the policies that can best help us defeat an enemy that is sworn to our destruction.
And it's a great website, defenseofdemocracies.org.
Defenddemocracy.org
is the website. Yeah, it's a great website, and it's got people like Claudia Rosette, who we've had on here as a guest, and Andy McCarthy, who we've had on here as a guest, and Walid Ferries. And
yep.
I urge everyone to go visit that site, and it's very informative. When you were at the Times, were you in any way, did you feel your conservative instincts there, and were you in any way uncomfortable, or did you feel out of place in any way?
Yeah, I was drifting, I guess I would, towards conservatism over time, and the more I did, the more I developed opinions, and the more I recognized these were the wrong opinions to have at this institution, the more uncomfortable it did become. And I think what happens over time is that conservatives find it's untenable to remain at the Times, with very, very few exceptions. I mean, you know, Bill Sapphire as a columnist, although people were not friendly to him for many years, eventually he became an institution. David Brooks is over there now, again, as a columnist. But as a reporter, it's difficult. Now, I played my cards very close to the vest. I had been trained in the school of journalism where a good reporter doesn't show his opinions. He doesn't let his opinions leak into the story. But even the problem was that everybody else around me was letting their opinions leak into their stories.
Yeah, well, you recently went to Pakistan. You really picked quite a time to go there this month. It's been just amazingly deadly and some of the most audacious actions taken by the jihadists, the Taliban, you know, I want to get into that terminology as well, taking hostages at basically the Department of Defense there. Why is this happening now? And tell us what you found out while you were over there.
Well, as you point out, it was an active time, but it's getting more and more active. There were 4 terrorist attacks while I was there. But there have been more than 100 over the past couple of years. And in fact, at least 5,000 Pakistanis have been killed in acts of terrorism since 9/11. Most people don't recognize that. You've got the Pakistani Taliban, and you've got also the Afghan Taliban, which has taken refuge on Pakistani territory, as has Al-Qaeda. Although it's Pakistani territory, to be fair, that is very wild and woolly. It's part of the country along the Afghan border where the federal government of Pakistan, a country that was formed in 1947, carved out of India as a safe haven for Muslims, the federal government has never really exercised a lot of control in those areas. That said, it is a problem if they are tolerating Al-Qaeda and the Taliban as these groups prepare attacks on us, either in Afghanistan or elsewhere in the world. So I was there to talk about terrorism, of all things, with government officials, with religious leaders, on campuses. These were lively conversations, you can bet.
So what is the thinking there? What are we not seeing in the news that you picked up and, you know, that's relevant about the situation?
Pakistan is a very important country. It's obviously not just a Muslim-majority country. It's now 97% Muslim because, although when the country was formed, there were Christians, Hindus, quite a few Sikhs, even some Jews, but they have not felt comfortable over the decades that passed, even though the country was meant to be secular and tolerant and pluralistic. It has nuclear weapons, as you know, and in fact, Osama bin Laden has said he wants those nuclear weapons that Pakistan has. They should be turned over to him, and one way or another, he says they will be over time. They play an important role in Afghanistan, though there's tension between Afghans and Pakistanis on many levels. They're an important ally, but not an entirely reliable ally. I think you don't want to paint everybody with the same brush. I met a lot of wonderful people in Pakistan who are against terrorism, who want to be close friends with the U.S., who want a pluralistic society. But there are also those who essentially distinguish between the good Taliban and the bad Taliban, and essentially what they mean is the bad Taliban attacks Pakistanis, the good Taliban attacks Americans in Afghanistan, where the Americans are occupiers. Their arguments are not always consistent. You have Pakistanis say, you know, that we have the problems in Afghanistan now because the U.S. Abandoned Afghanistan once the Soviets were thrown out. And the Soviets were thrown out with U.S. help, as you know, with Pakistani help, for sure, with Saudi money as well. People have seen Charlie Wilson's War. Haven't gotten exactly the true story, but it's not that far from the truth. My response always was, explain to me something. You complain that we abandoned Afghanistan. That's a terrible thing. We shouldn't have done it. You complain that we are occupying Afghanistan. That's a terrible thing. We shouldn't be doing it. So essentially, you're saying there are just two things Americans should remember they must not do. We must not stay, and we must not leave. Anything else we can do? What are the other options, after all?
And the Pakistani president, Zardari, his widow was killed by these terrorists. So
that's right. We believe was killed by the Taliban, by the Pakistani Taliban, led at that time by Tula Masood. Pretty terrible man. In August, one of our U.S. Predators missiles killed him, which is good. But now it's led by another family member, Hakimullah Masood. Since when I was there, of the four terrorist attacks that took place, the most consequential was on the general headquarters of the military. That's essentially the Pentagon. And this was not a minor attack. This was not some guy running in with a gun or a bomb. It was a 22-hour assault. The terrorists wore army uniforms, whether they stole them or borrowed them or were soldiers who had turned, I don't think we know. They killed senior officers, a brigadier, a colonel, three commandos. They took hostages. They were eventually beaten. But I think it was the first time I think that a lot of Pakistanis were actually shocked by a terrorist act in a way they hadn't been before, because it was, I mean, the army is the most important institution in the country. And since then, there's been a campaign against the Taliban in some of these tribal areas, south and north Waziristan. And what we don't know yet for sure is how successful this campaign against the Taliban is. There have also been other terrorist attacks since then. It's a way for the Taliban to say, you think you're going to come after us, we're going to come after you. But it's important, if this campaign goes well and really roots out the Taliban from its bases, and what we know increasingly is that these are not just caves. These are whole cities that they control, whole towns, whole roads. They have their own police. I mean, it's a Taliban mini-state we're talking about. If they can really destroy them, defeat them, and then hold the area for the long term, that'll be consequential, because combatants from Afghanistan go to this Taliban mini-state in Pakistan to rest, to train, to recruit, to build bombs that they take with them to kill Americans and Afghans in subsequent battles.
So let's talk more about Afghanistan. Last March, President Obama announced his policy of counterinsurgency there, and soon thereafter picked his own general to take command, General McChrystal, who then issued his report, which was sort of suppressed for a while until it was leaked to Bob Woodward at the Post. Since then, Obama has been very publicly considering his options. So is he, as Dick Cheney said, dithering, or is he, as he says, giving sort of sacred and careful consideration, unlike his predecessors? Give us your take on this situation.
Well, it's hard to know for sure. What I'm most concerned with, I don't mind him giving consideration or even reconsideration to his strategy, but I would argue that it needs to be consideration or reconsideration of not just Afghanistan, but the global struggle we're fighting against militant Islamists. And my fear is that he doesn't see it that way. The Bush administration fought something it called the global war on terrorism. Not a great phrase. We're not really, terrorism is just, after all, a weapon used by our enemies. It's not what we're fighting any more than in World War One. We had a global war against submarines, or in World War Two there was a war against German rockets. But okay, at least it understood the global nature of the struggle. What the current administration seems to think it is fighting, what it calls overseas contingency operations. That's not a war. That's not a global conflict. I'm not sure they're acknowledging we are fighting a global conflict. And if you don't acknowledge that, it's very hard to understand where Afghanistan fits in. I would argue Afghanistan is not a war. It is a battle. It is a front. It is a theater in the war. And if you want to win the war globally, you have to think about all the battles you have to fight and where resources can be most effectively deployed in order to win the global war. Afghanistan in and of itself is not a very consequential stretch of territory. But it is important because of Pakistan. It is important because that's where Al-Qaeda and the Taliban are headquartered. And if you could defeat them there, that would be consequential, though you'd still be left with Iran, which for 30 years has been waging a war against the United States, albeit one which we chose most of the time to ignore.
So you raise a good point, how Obama views this situation that we're in. In other words, do his duties as commander-in-chief come into conflict with his views on trying to change the relationship between the U.S. and the Arab and Muslim world?
Well, it's not so much conflict, but if a strategy in this war is to try to make America inoffensive to our enemies, I think I feel pretty confident to say that's going to fail. I think it would have to be based on a misunderstanding of who our enemies are, why they hate us, and what they want. But there are a lot of people who believe, well, they hate us because they have legitimate grievances, they're fighting national liberation struggles, if they know that our intentions are good, it'll all be fine. That's not going to happen. And one of the things that was very clear when I was in Pakistan is that, you know, people like President Obama. They like him better than they like President Bush, but it changes nothing. It changes nothing. Even, and I don't mean just among the terrorists or the radical Islamists. I remember being on one TV show. It was called Islamabad Tonight, and one of the guests on the panel with me, very sophisticated Pakistani guy, said, "Look, Obama wants to be in Afghanistan for 40 years." And I said, "Whatever you say about Obama," I said, "believe me, he doesn't want to be in Afghanistan for 40 years. I don't think he wants to be there for 40 days. Why would you say something like that?" And he said, "Oh, you don't understand, Cliff. This is about great power politics, a great game. It's about all kinds of geostrategic reasons. It doesn't matter who the president is. He wants the American president's going to want to be in Afghanistan for 40 years. Obama is no different." That's the point of view not of some crazy Islamist, but of a sophisticated, educated Pakistani.
So you think Obama's view that if we only show them respect and that we're not this bully that they like to portray the previous administration as, that in fact they will come around and, you know, stop all this fighting and killing and all that? I mean,
it not only won't make things better, it'll make things worse, because they will see this as weakness, and they will exploit it every way they can. It will fail. It cannot possibly succeed. I'd love to be wrong. I'd love to come back and say, you know what, I misunderstood. Look what's happened since then. But it's not. But I know that's not the case. And we can see since the Cairo speech, where the Cairo speech has not made any one of the more than 50 Muslim-majority countries in the world say, you know what, he's come halfway, time for us to move halfway. Let's really do something. Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can, let's try harder to make peace with Israel. Let's try to make sure that Iran doesn't develop nuclear weapons when it has a regime that is aggressive and bellicose and threatening death to America and to wipe Israel off the earth. We haven't seen anything come of that beneficial, and we are not going to. I'm afraid it's very much of the same spirit of appeasement that we saw in the 1930s, and it doesn't work.
So where does this road lead then? I mean, if our commander-in-chief has this misunderstanding of the enemy we're fighting, then what are the national security consequences of that?
Not promising. I think it means things will get much worse before they get better. Maybe before there is a recognition of reality.
So on Afghanistan, what seems to be the consensus forming is that Obama is going to announce sometime next week or between the election, the 7th and the 11th of November, he's going to announce some kind of what they're calling McChrystal Light, maybe, where he'll say we'll go an extra 10,000 troops or something. Do you have any inside information on this, or what do you, if he does that, what do you think that decision would say?
Yeah, I have no inside information.
Okay.
I think it would be a mistake. Either you commit to the battle or you don't. To kind of commit halfway, it's like, you know, you're on a mountain and trying to jump to the next peak. You either want to stay where you are or go all the way. If you go halfway, you're going to end up in the crevasse between them. And I wonder what McChrystal will say. Will McChrystal say, all right, I'll make do with that, that's okay? Or will he say, you know what, I don't have the resources to win. I don't think I want to be a general who presides over a slow motion defeat. I'm going to leave this to somebody else and resign. I think, well, very hard to see quite what happens. Mm-hmm. But it's not, McChrystal, as you point out, is Obama's handpicked commander for that theater. He has done his review. He says he knows what has to be done in order to secure that battlefield, to defeat the Taliban, hopefully to finally destroy al-Qaeda. I think it's worth doing, by the way. I think it's worth doing, not least because al-Qaeda and the Taliban are important enemies, not our only enemies. Again, Iran is as well. But they're important. They're kind of on the ropes now, although we've let them come back a bit. Now's the time to push. If we can defeat them in South Asia, where they've been since 1988, having beaten al-Qaeda in Iraq, whatever you think of the intervention in Iraq, beating al-Qaeda there was consequential, we'll have gone a long way towards destroying this enemy. Doesn't mean there won't be other groups. Again, Iran's still there, and there'll be groups that are inspired by the martyrdom of bin Laden if we kill him. Absolutely, it's not over with. But battles won are better than battles lost. And it's not so easy, even if they escape from there, for them to pick up and go to, I don't know, Somalia or someplace and reestablish themselves the way they have in these wild areas of Afghanistan and Pakistan. It just won't be. So they'll stand out. They're comfortable where they are. They'll be uncomfortable where they go. If they're on the run, they can't do much harm to us. Part of the strategy in this war is always to keep your enemies on the run, looking over their shoulder, afraid to sleep at night. That's the way you want them. Don't let them get comfortable, because if you do, they will plan and they will carry out terrible attacks. We haven't had an attack on American soil for 8 years. That is a kind of victory. If we want another 8 years, we better be on the offensive, not in retreat, not on defensive. We're not going to win this war by having people take off their shoes at airports.
Well, when you see this story on the front page of yesterday's New York Times, the headline, Brother of Afghan Leader Said to Be Paid by the CIA, both as a former New York Times reporter, do you question, you know, who leaked this, the timing, is this to help defeat Karzai, could that be by the administration, you know, or that James Carville is representing Abdullah, you know, what do you, when you see a story like that, I mean, what do you think, or in this, I mean, specifically, what do you think of this story and the timing of it?
It sounds like a lot of times when you have these leaks, it's somebody in the administration who wants his policy enacted rather than even the president's or anybody else. But there was leaking going on all the time against Bush in order to foreclose his options or to try to direct the policy in a certain way. It's very wrong. I think those who do the leaking should have been prosecuted under the Bush administration, should be prosecuted under this administration. They're in the government. They take an oath for secrecy if they're in the clandestine services or in the State Department. We should be making some examples. I would assume they're either against Karzai or they're against the whole enterprise in Afghanistan, and they see this as a way of creating bad publicity and again, having their policy carried out rather than the president's or Congress's.
Obama has made peace between Israel and the Palestinians one of his top priorities, but from the way I look at it, I think a deal is further from reality than any time in recent history. I mean, I think in some ways that by making the settlements such an important factor when it really wasn't up until then, that has sort of drawn lines. I mean, give me your view on what's going on there and what's likely to happen in the coming months and year or so.
Look, it gets back to what we were saying earlier, Roger. Israel and the Palestinian territories that's one more theater, one more front in this global war. You can think about how you fight on that front, but you're not going to get a peace in that area until you destroy militant Islamism. Imagine for a second, hard to do, but just imagine it, that you are an advisor to, say, Mahmoud Abbas, the leader of Fatah and the Palestinian Authority. You're his advisor. And he says, what do you think? Should I strike a deal with the Israelis? Should we figure out where to draw the borders? Should we just get this conflict over once and for all? It'll be better for our children. Wouldn't you, as his advisor, say, I don't think so, Mahmoud. Let me tell you why. Sadat did that a few years ago. He made peace with Israel. He came to Israel. He recognized Israel's existence, said, we're going to live with you as our neighbor. And you know what happened to Sadat? He was gunned down. He was killed by militant Islamists, by a group led by Ayman al-Zawahiri, who is now Osama bin Laden's deputy in these wild areas of Pakistan. So if you do, Mahmoud, what Sadat did, you got to figure you're going to end up as Sadat ended up. And I'd like to see you around for a few more years rather than dead. So I think not. I think it would be a mistake to make peace with Israel. What do you gain? And it's not going to be, the peace is not going to last anyhow.
And of course you have the situation with Hamas and in Gaza and Fatah and the West Bank. And you have, you know, these intractable issues, right of return, and I don't see where there's any room for optimism and, you know, any reason to hope for a deal, you know, at this
point. Hamas, which controls Gaza, has essentially the same ideology as the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. It is focused on one piece of territory, but if you just look at what Hamas leaders have said, while they act locally, they think globally. They are part of the worldwide militant jihad against the West. They have been very clear, admirably candid, that they have no intention of making peace with Israel or living side by side with a Jewish state. The leaders of Hamas are deeply religious people, and their interpretation of their religion may seem radical to some, but they believe it. They're not talking about negotiating postures. What they're talking about are their religious convictions. And among their religious convictions is this, that any stretch of land ever conquered by Muslims is an endowment from Allah to the Muslims for eternity, a waqf, an endowment. And as Muslims, they believe it is their duty to regain land that infidels now hold, or they can shirk their religious duty, but there's nothing other, there are no other options for them. They are fighting for the annihilation and destruction of Israel. They are not fighting to have a better deal, a better peace process that ends up with a Palestinian state and a Jewish state. They're not that interested, actually, in a Palestinian state. They're interested in destroying an infidel state.
So we're almost out of time, but let's take on one more thing kind of briefly, which is Iran, which is, in fact, a sponsor of Hamas as well as of Hezbollah. And Obama's policy has been to try to come and extend a softer hand toward them, both to get them to stop building nuclear weapons and to stop terrorism, supporting terrorism. And how is all that working out?
Well, it's not. It's not working out at all. He has reached out a hand in respect and engagement and friendship, and it's been slapped back. The Iranians have no interest in being his friend, and no interest in that. They want to be feared more than respected. They want nuclear weapons, which will engender that fear and give them an umbrella to protect the terrorist groups that they sponsor, such as Hamas and Hezbollah. You can say, well, Obama had to try it. He's gotten a lot of things in life by being charming, but I think he reached the limit, and it's time to recognize that and figure out what else there is one can do. And the most immediately, I would say crippling sanctions should be tried. Congress is now considering that. May not work, but why not utilize it? It's the last possible peaceful way to prevent this regime from getting nuclear weapons. But the Obama policy has not paid off at all in terms of Iran so far.
Well, how have they done in terms of promoting human rights and democracy, both you'd say, with China, but also coming back to Iran, where we're looking at the situation, you know, when the people were rising up in the streets after the, you know, what everyone assumes to be a stolen or fraudulent election, and it was a great opportunity to possibly back the people against the regime and find a way to overthrow it without going to war. And I think, you know, a lot of people see that as a missed opportunity. I mean, do you view it that way?
Yeah, I think it's. I think so. I think we should be supporting the people who are protesting the repression they have suffered for 30 years under this regime. And we know the elections were fraudulent. The results were announced before ballots were counted. Mousavi lost in his home district, very unlikely since it's a particular ethnic group. And there was hardly a word of support for them, and certainly no actions were taken in support of those who were our opponents of the regime. I think that is a missed opportunity. If we had a different regime in that country, we might not be so worried about the nuclear weapons.
Well, Cliff, we're going to have to leave it there. Why don't you one more time tell people how they can come visit your website? And
yep. www.defenddemocracy.org. Should be lots of fresh content and interesting things for people to take a look at.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
You bet. Next up, going to bring on my co-host, Don Irvine. Hi, Don, you there?
I'm here, Roger.
Okay, good. So I'm going to turn the rest of the show over to you. I'll come back at the end, but take it away.
Okay. Leslie, are you there?
Hi, Don. This is Leslie.
Hey, good to hear. Good to hear from you.
It's good to talk to you. Thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure. Let me start with a brief intro. Leslie is a writer living in Virginia. Her work has appeared in magazines, including The Weekly Standard and American Enterprise and National Review Online. Ms. Carbone has served as the chief of staff to the late Assemblyman Gil Ferguson of California, director of family tax policy at the Family Research Council, and a speechwriter for U.S. Secretary of Labor Elaine L. Chao. And she has just published a book called Slaying the Leviathan. Eli Lehrer, former senior editor to the American Enterprise, had this to say about her book: Leslie Carbone's argument for restoring virtue, justice, and common sense to fiscal policy is a vital contribution to the debate over taxes. Anyone who wants to understand the moral price of our tax system should read this book. Great endorsement there.
Thanks. Yes, it was. I was very encouraged by all the nice words that people have said, but really even more so just by how much people care about taxation as a moral issue. You know, we've seen since the big bailout fight last year and then the stimulus and everything going on, people really waking up to what this overbearing government that we're paying for means. And so it's exciting to see people going to tea parties and 9/12 March and the town halls and everything. It's a great time to be fighting Leviathan.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the book and about, you know, U.S. tax policy. Why did you decide to write the book? How did this all come about?
Well, you know, for a long time we've known that high tax rates and especially high marginal income tax rates are bad for the economy. You know, they suppress job creation, they suppress wage growth, they suppress prosperity, make it harder for you to save money to start your own business or whatever you want to do. And all those things are extremely important. But I also felt that there was a moral component. You know, it's virtuous behavior that creates wealth. You know, hard work, saving, responsible risk-taking, these are the things that create prosperity. The things that create poverty are not working, not saving, taking foolish risks. And unfortunately, you know, over the last 100 years or so, our fiscal policy has been structured in such a way as to reward the people who choose the foolish behavior that leads against prosperity, and to pay for the reward on the backs of the people who have the virtuous behavior that creates prosperity. So there's a, you know, there's a moral lesson there. There's a government imprimatur on vice, and like a fine on virtue.
Now, we haven't always had an income tax policy and everything. Where did that begin? Why did that begin?
Well, you're right. We haven't always had an income tax, and I think up until the Progressive Era, just the very idea of that was anathema. You know, direct taxes were one of the things that were really fought about in the Constitutional Convention. But, you know, about 100 years after that, the Progressive Era really started to steam. We'd had the Industrial Revolution, corporations were getting bigger, and people started to get a little envious, kind of resentful, that some people were creating more wealth. And a lot of leading intellectuals came up with some ideas that really only intellectuals could believe. You know, basically Marxist notions. You know, Marx was one of the main proponents of a progressive income tax. For this very kind of idea that if you've achieved prosperity, if you've achieved wealth, you know, somehow you've taken something from somebody else. You know, it's this mistaken notion that, you know, economic wealth is like a pie, and the pie is only so big, and if one person gets a bigger slice of the pie, you know, somebody else necessarily has to have a smaller slice, and something's been taken from them. Well, you know, the progressive movement got started around the, you know, late 1800s. You know, they elected a few people to Congress and so on. They didn't get really successful until a little bit later when the Great Depression hit. And then a lot of people were out of work. And, you know, people who weren't out of work were worried about what was going to happen to them next, what was going to happen to their families. And, you know, these ideas, which people had pretty much rejected up to that point, were still out there and talked about. And they'd kind of settled, and people started thinking about that more and more. And when you're scared, when you've lost your job or you're worried about losing your job, you're concerned about how to take care of your family, kids, what's going to happen to your parents, you're a little more amenable to ideas like government should just take care of you. And then, you know, there we had it, you know, the creation of the welfare state. So it's, you know, ideas start out, and people don't pay much attention to them, but then they sort of take root. And, you know, so we see the progressive era taking root. They get the progressive income tax by building upon that resentment, and then they get into this redistributionary spending policy, and it just has grown and grown. Until, you know, here we are today.
Now, do you think the government can survive without an income, without income tax, without that revenue?
Well, unfortunately, as we know, the government's currently running a deficit, and so not having income tax revenue doesn't really seem to trouble it. It just borrows money from China. It's, you know, a scary thing on a whole different level. But, you know, more to the point, what the federal government ought to be doing is laid out in Article 1, Section 8 of our Constitution. And the government doesn't need anywhere near the amount of money that it takes, not just in personal income taxes, but in all kinds of taxes, to fulfill those functions. You know, people don't want this big health care plan that they're talking about today. They didn't want the stimulus plan. They didn't want the bank bailout and the auto bailout. And they shouldn't have wanted those things. They're not in the Constitution. They were expensive boondoggles. You know, it just got released today that the silly Cash for Clunkers program cost taxpayers $24,000 per car. This is crazy. So, you know, can the Leviathan Big Brother nanny state that we have now survive without all the taxes? Well, no, and it shouldn't. government survive at the level that it's supposed to and leave the decisions and the responsibilities that the federal government doesn't have to fulfill to the states, to the local governments, as well as to the families, the communities, the individuals? Absolutely.
Well, relatively speaking, income tax rates are somewhat low compared to, you know, historical averages. How far back do we have to go to what I guess some people would say that were even confiscatory income tax rates? I mean, they are better. Probably, it's still not good enough, probably, by your viewpoint, but are they not better as a whole?
Well, you know, once we actually had a marginal income tax rate of 100%. Now, that was something that was put in by Franklin Delano Roosevelt by executive order, and it didn't, because Congress, which was a little wiser then than it is now, rescinded it. But when President Jack Kennedy took office, it was 91%. Well, he slashed it to 70%, and Ronald Reagan slashed it further ultimately to 28%, and then Bush and Bush 1 and Clinton then rose it back up again. An income tax rate of a little less than 40%, which is what we've got now, is much, much better than an income tax rate of 100% or 91% or 70%, sure. But the principle of a progressive tax code where the more you earn, the more wealth you create, the more prosperity you build, the higher percentage you have to pay. You know, you don't just pay, you know, a flat percentage where if you make a little more, then you pay a little more on the same scale. But the actual proportion that you have to pay goes up is really discriminatory law. And it's an affront to the idea of equality under the law. It becomes a tyranny of the majority, because then you've got, you know, 51% thinking that they can just tax 49% at whatever rate they want, and that becomes a very scary thing. And that, you know, as I talked about at the beginning of the program, the dampening of prosperity that causes has been well documented for decades, and the moral harm that it creates is at least as dangerous.
Now, conservatives and libertarians seem to be, in that broad mix, they seem to be a little bit at odds about tax policy, in the sense of there's a lot of discussion of flat tax or fair tax. Do you have an opinion on either of those proposals?
Well, the last section of my book actually talks about the flat tax and the fair tax and other ideas for a national sales tax. And it also talks about things like estate tax reform. Earlier in the book, you know, I lay out the tax history and the spending history of the U.S., and then I talk about the principles of why a lot of what's happened in the last 100 years is problematic. So then in the last section, when I talk about the different tax plans, I evaluate them based on the principles that I've laid out earlier in the book. Now, my book doesn't take a specific position in favor of one specific plan, and I did that very, very purposefully. You know, I'm really looking forward to the day when we're having a national discussion about, okay, this income tax, this progressive income tax system is just out of control. We've got to change it. And then we're talking about what to do. Do we want a flat income tax? Do we want a fair tax? What do we want? But I don't think we're there yet. I think we're still at the point of really exploring, fully understanding just what's wrong with the system that we've got. And then once we have a clearer grasp and the majority on board with understanding that, then we can start talking about what to do about it. You know, we've seen with the bank bailout and the stimulus and all the stuff that's happened in the last year in particular, what happens, what mischief occurs when government says, oh, there's a problem, let's do something. We don't know what, we don't have time to think about it, we don't have time to read the bill, we just have to do something. I want to avoid that. I want to have a robust national debate about the problems with progressive taxation and all the possible solutions for it, so that we can vet ideas, so that, you know, we can all come together and talk about it as citizens of a free republic and come to the best solution.
One of the things that's near and dear to my heart is your public education, having, you know, putting my kids through public education, the same system where I grew up. And you talk about between 1960 and 1990, spending on elementary and secondary education has jumped from $50 billion to nearly $190 billion in inflation-adjusted dollars. But then during the same period, per student spending more than tripled from $1,454 to $4,622. What are we getting for that money? What's wrong here?
Well, less and less good education, unfortunately. You know, I always say the easiest way to destroy anything is to put federal government control over it. And that clearly is happening in public education. The people who settled this country, set up local schools. You know, the country was settled mostly by Christians who wanted to make sure that kids could read the Bible. And that's really how, public education got started, in my home area of New England. And it's simply common sense that local control, local parents who can watch what's going on in their school are going to, hold that school more accountable. And they're also going to be able to have the pressure to make sure that that school is responding to the needs of the students in that particular area. When you create a federal department, and then you give a bunch of bureaucrats, say, to create tests and all this stuff, and just give money without any real parental accountability, you're asking for trouble. It's the same thing that we see in so many other areas where the government is involved, where they take money from taxpayers and then they give it out to who they think they can give it to better than those taxpayers can, and in the meantime they've cut the taxpayers off from the consumer power to impose accountability on the schools or whatever it is in question that they're paying for indirectly through the expensive, overbearing, mediating bureaucracy of the government.
So does that make a case for charter schools or vouchers as a more efficient way of using our money?
Well, my book addresses federal fiscal policy, and those are really state issues, as you may know. And I live in Virginia, and I've written on charter schools and educational choice for Virginia, and I think those are things that certainly I would encourage all states to consider very carefully and think about implementing. But again, my book doesn't really delve into the state level education policies per se, other than the larger point of getting the federal government out of all the places where it doesn't belong.
Now, in looking at federal tax policy, you kind of briefly mentioned when we were talking about fair tax and flat tax and national sales tax. I mean, you kind of alluded a little bit to even estate tax. I believe you in the past you had even either co-authored or at least participated in a book about divorce. I guess there's the tax implications of what happens, with divorce. And is it more of an incentive to be divorced or married, for tax policy? Are these things that are just crazy out there, or what's the deal?
Well, we talk about the marriage penalty, where, bottom line is when you have a progressive tax code where the more money, the more income that you have, the higher rate you have. The one thing that happens is when two people get married and they start being taxed together, they are very frequently forced into that higher rate. And so they end up paying more in taxes simply for being married. And, for some people, this amounts to thousands of dollars. Well, you know, a lot of people just don't get married because of that. They just choose cohabitation because it's cheaper. And, of course, that, you know, leads to all the social pathologies that we know result from that. But in some instances, people actually have gotten divorced because of it. And there was one couple who eventually the IRS cracked down on them. But they used to get divorced at the end of every year. And then you get remarried the next year just so that they could file singly. And then they'd take a big vacation with the money that they saved. So it's that kind of silly behavior that our tax code encourages. You know, did they set it up that way on purpose? No, of course not. That's one of the myriad unintended consequences when the government starts doing things, you know, like progressive taxation, like a wealth creation. They didn't see it coming, but you know, here it is, and we have the economic and the moral consequences of it.
Somehow I don't think my wife would go along with this idea.
Well, good for your wife. But, you know, that actually brings up a point, because there are, you know, a lot of people out there who obviously have gone along with it. Well, what does that mean? Well, it means that they have more relative buying power than you do. You know, it basically rewards people or punishes people, you know, for choosing virtuous behavior. And you know, allows the people who are, you know, creating the social pathologies, you know, that come from cohabitation and divorce, to have more economic power. That's, you know, that's backwards.
Okay, so now you mentioned the Cash for Clunkers report today, and you know, we've talked a little bit, I guess, at least peripherally, about the stimulus bill and things like that, and how much of an effect it has on taxpayers. The taxpayers obviously don't realize the real effect of that. You know, they went out in droves and bought cars and cleared the lots and everything like that. Obviously, the news media thought that this seemed to be a pretty good idea. They seemed to ignore the implications for taxpayers that we're going to be seeing on these types of things. You know, what about programs like that? What about tax credits that are built into the system, or the homeowners buyer credit, you know, this $8,000 first-time homeowners buyer? That doesn't seem to be working all that well. I mean, it seems to have stimulated housing to a certain extent, but there's still going to be a bigger price to pay later on, are there not?
Well, this gets into a really complicated area when you get into tax credits, tax deductions. You know, on the one hand, it lets you keep more of your money away from the government is a good thing. But where did all these come from? Well, you know, they came from a progressive tax code that takes so much money that it more or less has to give you a tax break, you know, in order to be able to buy a house or do any of the other things, you know, that people want to be able to do, you know, in an advanced society. Well, you know, before we had this, you know, $8,000 first-time homebuyer's credit, you know, we had the mortgage interest deduction, because government wants to encourage homeownership because we think it's a mark of a stable society. Okay, that's true, but it's not the government's role to engage in that kind of social engineering. What the government should be doing is taxing us as minimally as possible, and then letting us as families, as individuals, as taxpayers decide, you know, what's best in our situation. Is it, you know, a bigger house, or is it, you know, maybe private education for the kids so that they don't have to be in those federally controlled schools? You know, those are the things that we should be able to make as individuals, you know, without the government actually steering us into what it wants to sanction for our choices. It's an inappropriate exercise of power for the government to try to make those kinds of decisions through tax incentives and disincentives for the families. I mean, you know, you stack up the average family against, you know, a tax writing bureaucrat who's going to make the better decision. I mean, 99% of the time, my money is on the family.
So I take it you wouldn't be, you're not too crazy about the Social Security and Medicare tax.
No, I'm not. You know, that is, when we talk about progressive taxes, that's actually a regressive tax. The Social Security portion is because they take it from the first dollar, and then the first dollar that you earn, and then cap it in a limit that changes every year. So we get the opposite of a progressive tax. You get people at the lowest end paying that tax, and then at the higher end, they stop having to pay it. Well, who gets squeezed the most from that? Well, the middle class, of course, because, you know, it's the lower class that's not paying income taxes but is paying payroll taxes, and it's the upper class that is not paying the payroll tax or not paying the Social Security portion but is paying income tax. Who's paying both? The middle class. I mean, this is crazy. But, you know, more to the point, what the Social Security system has done is supplant the individual as being responsible for his own future. You know, when they take, you know, basically 15%, if you include the employer's portion of how much you make, you know, that's a significant chunk of money that you could be investing a whole lot more responsibly and getting a much bigger return than you're getting on Social Security. And it's a planning family responsibility. You know, instead, you know, people used to feel much more of an obligation to take care of the people in their own family, take care of their parents if they needed it. And what this does is it has a bureaucracy stepping into the family and giving kind of a false moral cover to people who don't want to take care of their own, who just want, you know, the other taxpayers to do it through a bureaucracy.
Hey, Leslie, we're almost out of time. Just want to wrap this up. Do you want to give contact information on how people can get your book or to follow you or on Twitter or whatever?
Well, they can get my book on Amazon.com. Just search on Slaying Leviathan. I have a blog, leslicarbone.blogspot.com, where they can see more of what I've written, and also there's a link to purchase the book there. And my Twitter ID is just Leslie Carbone. So, yeah, feel free to follow me and say hello.
All right. Well, great. Thank you for coming on and being with me today.
Oh, thank you for having me on, Don. I appreciate it.
All right. We'll talk to you later. Thanks.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, Don, that was a great interview. Very informative. I'm looking forward to reading her book. So just to review what's happened recently, I think your dad, Reed, would have been proud with our 40th anniversary conference last Friday, which was carried live on C-SPAN 2 for the whole 8 hours or so. What impressions do you have from that day?
I think you're right. I mean, I in my remarks, one of the things I thought about later on that maybe I should have said was something to the degree of, you know, had my father been here today with us, that I think he would have been very pleased at the way the conference turned out. Great content all the way through from beginning to end, really. I think the viewers on C-SPAN learned a lot. I'm sure the people in attendance learned a lot about the various subjects a little more on whether or not it was torture or global warming or new media, civility, those types of things. There was just a lot of information there. It was just a great, great conference.
Yes, I've gotten a lot of great response, people who saw it, and then people can come to our website because all of this has been archived on C-SPAN, and if you get our daily emails, every day you would get a link to a different segment. So, again, we urge you to come sign up for our daily emails. And, yeah, it was terrific. Just really fun and interesting and informative. So, we'll do it again 40 years from now, but hopefully a lot sooner than that as well.
I'm not sure I'm going to be around in 40 more years.
Well, we'll make sure that AIM is one way or another. Anyway, we're going to be back next week for another show. And again, I just want to encourage you. You can see we had, if you go look up these links, we had Andy McCarthy's speech. We had a great panel on global warming with Lord Monckton, who was Margaret Thatcher's advisor. We had Jonah Goldberg speak. Cliff Kincaid brought in Trevor Loudon from New Zealand, who has done a lot of research that the American media should have been doing, but hasn't been doing. But that's about it for this week, and just going to sign off and urge you to come back next week and go to our website at aim.org. Thank you. Until next week, so long.